Hello, I'm Caroline Baum, and welcome to this podcast of a conversation recorded live at True Story, the festival of non-fiction held on the land of the Wadi Wadi people at the South Coast Writers' Centre at Coaldale in New South Wales. We pay our respects to the traditional owners of the land and their storytellers. Rick Morton is one of the most significant voices in journalism to have emerged in recent years. His debut, 100 Years of Dirt, is an eloquent memoir of growing up in poverty. We invited him to True Story to give a specially commissioned keynote address about his investigative account of the robo-debt scandal and its impact on him and on its victims in his book Mean Streak. Mixing anger with humour is a tricky balancing act, but Rick pulled it off.
Thank you for having me, everyone. Are we as awake as I am? Because I'm trying to be awake. It's been a long day. Noah Webster was working on the Great American Dictionary of 1806 when his wife came into the study to find him with the secretary upon his lap. "Noah, I am surprised," she said, to which the lexicographer replied, "No, my dear, you are astonished." It is we who are surprised. Fast forward a few years. In early 2011 or so, I'd written for an online outlet that children were being kept behind barbed wire on Christmas Island. After my article went live, the noted linguists over at the then Department of Immigration and Citizenship, media unit I should say, called to have my language corrected. "It's razor wire," the spokesman told me. And I said, "Excuse me, what now?" And he said, "We don't use barbed wire in our facilities, it's razor wire." I grew up on a cattle station in far west Queensland. I know I can get over barbed wire, and I'm telling you right now for free that I wouldn't make it halfway across razor wire. It's objectively a more prohibitive kind of wire. In any case, what difference did it make if the wire was razor or barbed, or if Noah Webster's wife was surprised or astonished exactly, because we know what is meant on both occasions. We human beings, that is. Now, you may think it odd or even troubling if I'm standing before you today at a writers' festival to address a festival designed by writers and readers for same to begin a lecture with a denunciation on the specificity of language. And before we lose any poets to nervous system failure, let me assure you, we are here simply to marvel at all the many uses of the English language. It can be preserved or adapted. It can be used to reveal or conceal. Art reveals, power conceals. And it is my contention that the language of government, of bureaucracy and power, was just as critical to the morbid success of the illegal debt-raising scheme known as robo-debt, as the moral and mathematical vacuity of its overseers. Seriously, this thing was like a Russian novel. It had 9 different names at one point. Internally, if not publicly, it was the pay-as-you-go cleanup, the manual intervention, the OCI, the staged improvement process, the ECI, the CUPI, and presumably on until the heat death of the universe or quantum computers found the last possible acronym combination. We must remember, however, that nothing about the essential features of this cash grab changed, even as its nomenclature did. So what did the powerful men and women of government do? They set out to bilk $1.2 billion from 866,000 people who were or had been on welfare by artificially populating every fortnight in the calendar year with income, even if they had not earned income in every fortnight of the year. They did this in the most crude way possible, by taking annual lump sums reported to the tax office and dividing these by 26 fortnights. On Centrelink, people are required to report their income, their earnings, every fortnight because entitlements are calculated every fortnight. If you are broke and without means one fortnight, you deserve support. But if you find some work in the following fortnight, your entitlement reduces until it reaches zero. If you're earning money and enough to support yourself, that's great news. Income averaging, as this fantasy was called, had the effect of conjuring debts where none existed or vastly inflated ones that did. The senior officials had evidence of this, by the way, long before the program actually started in July 2015. And the Department of Social Services also had legal advice that stated very clearly that actually this was very illegal, this idea, and everyone was very silly for even entertaining it. These twin roadblocks, terminal, one would have thought, were overcome by the power of positive thinking and a little light misleading of Cabinet, according to the Royal Commission that eventually inquired into this uniquely craven period of Australian history. It is worth spending a little time exploring how exactly this forgery was able to spring from the loins of ministerial ambition and a flank of the Australian Public Service that had been twisted and misshapen by a command and control leadership that infected dozens upon dozens of otherwise good bureaucrats and at least six government departments and agencies. To bake an apple pie, you must first create the universe, but we'll go back only so far as Tony Abbott. Another apple pie. His 2013 convincing election win is where we begin, with the debt and deficit disaster, a nation apparently so constricted by the strictures of red tape that we needed two pagan equinox festivals each year just to sacrifice various rules around a bonfire in Parliament House. And finally, none of this mattered quite so much as the ideological scurvy of cutting the welfare state. Some men unwind by building model replicas of World War II bombers, and Abbott, he unwound by kicking people off the dole. His first budget was so cruel, so nakedly ruinous, that a country used to punching down on welfare recipients recoiled. Abbott proposed cutting off income support for 6 months of every year for every person aged under the age of 30. And that was going to continue on and off until they turned 30. And that was the nice option. We didn't know at the time, but before that, they'd countenance even worse options, kicking everyone under the age of 30 off the dole permanently until they turned 30. They were to receive nothing. Zip, zilch. And that idea, which was floated in Cabinet, was so odious that Kevin Andrews and Erica Betts were like, whoa, hang on a second. Kevin Andrews and Erica Betts. That's like being rescued from floodwaters by Harold Holt. Abbott's first big bang budget got jammed in the Senate, and his money men changed the budget rules for the following year in 2015. No spending without the equivalent saving, and savings did not count if they required legislation that was likely to get stuck in the Senate. Robodebt was born in this moment of time. Where Abbott had tried to kick the front door down, the next attempt was to sneak in through the plumbing system. Robodebt had to be sneaky, and with Kevin Andrews, that old plod, out and Scott Morrison in, it found the perfect chaperone. Morrison is a master of saying many words while saying absolutely nothing. His verbiage is to scrutiny what military aircraft chaff is to radar, confounding, often impenetrable. But know this, nothing he wanted to do could be done without the proactive obfuscation of senior public servants and the negligence or laziness of many, many more. Nothing he wanted to do could be done without them. And so a new policy of government went to Cabinet in 2015, and we were initially never told anything about it. In fact, it was just one measure in a bundle of four in the budget papers under the broad banner strengthening the integrity of welfare payments. Here is the sum total of what we were told in that very same budget. The government will achieve savings of $1.7 billion over 5 years by enhancing the Department of Human Services, DHS, fraud prevention and debt recovery capability and improving assessment processes. From 1 July, I'm reading it deliberately boring, by the way. It's not a failure of my capacity. I just also need people to love me all the time, so I I hesitated for a moment there. I can't commit to the bit. From 1 July 2015, DHS will implement an integrated package of compliance and process improvement initiatives, including improved automation and targeted strategies for fraud prevention in areas of high risk. Before we knew it as Robidebt, the brand new policy shimmered like a poltergeist, breaking stuff and throwing debts at people that were plucked from the ether via a collective bureaucratic hallucination. It was a vast misery and it was invisible. It was miserable. The term Robidebt was coined by reporter Ben Eltham just to give this thing a goddamn name that endured and was capable of entering the public consciousness. Almost 2 years passed before anyone even knew what was happening. What a secret business is the language of power. Once, in 2020, the then Department of Social Services Secretary Catherine Campbell, who ushered in this thing when she was the DHS boss under Scott Morrison, said, "I'm sorry, I don't know what Robidebt means." She well knew what it meant because she was laughing about it in a keynote speech at a public admin conference 2 years before that. But before the inquisitorial onslaught of parliamentary scrutiny, she invoked ignorance. When the European Space Agency launched its Rosetta craft and sent it flying for a decade across more than 6 billion kilometres of space to land on a 3.5-kilometre comet, itself travelling at 100,000 kilometres an hour, the most complex space mission since putting man on the moon, it was still a shade easier to hit than Robidebt was to grasp. Thank you. I just love space. All of which is to say that I was in that budget lockup. I remember sneering at the suggestion, as we always did when governments tried to magic budget savings through the deus ex machina of yet more compliance, that this was anything more than a cheap parlour game, as if it could be. I'd reported on compliance measures that went nowhere and would again in the silent 2 years before this Robidebt measure emerged from its chrysalis. By then, it had already been extended in the mid-year forecasts of 2015 and extended again in the July 2016 double dissolution election to render Robidebt a $2 billion golden goose. Its origins in that May 2015 budget, obscured so easily, were long since forgotten. People forget that we didn't know Scott Morrison was the author of this policy until a footnote in the Ombudsman's report in May 2017. And even then, in the summer of 2016-17, when good journalists like Christopher Norse at The Guardian Australia and great activists like Asher Wolf were exposing the key features of this debt swindle in the public arena, I dismissed it. Centrelink had always been prone to bastardry, I thought. What was new? I didn't want to look any closer because I was worried about writing any kind of debt story for the Australian newspaper where I worked because I knew that they would put a spin on it. Well, what was new about this was plain to see for anybody who actually bothered to look. So few of us bothered to look. I was raised Catholic, which is why I'm standing before you today, almost a decade later, attempting to attend to my sins, but in the literal sense of paying attention to what has happened, to what continues to happen. This is what is required of all of us, especially in a world where the cloaking systems deployed over government policy are so crude and yet so effective that the Attorney General can be handed a report by the Robidebt Royal Commissioner Catherine Holmes making 57 recommendations and decide that actually there are only 56, and then challenge her to a public debate if she disagrees with him about what she wrote. That actually happened. That last recommendation, by the way, the one that was just disappeared by the Attorney General, there goes my slide, effectively disappeared the recommendation of the Commissioner to reform the Freedom of Information Act, which the federal government was never going to do. But they didn't want to say we accept all 56 recommendations and reject the final recommendation. They wanted to say we accepted all of them. And they didn't do that. They just pretended the 57th one didn't exist. So that last recommendation effectively disappeared, was to end the arbitrary secrecy provisions of the Freedom of Information Act, which was abused fulsomely throughout the history of Robodebt by labelling any document that threatened to reveal information about government policy, not deliberations of cabinet necessarily, but the actual policy details of things being done to Australians, as a cabinet document, even if it had never been so much as inside a cabinet room. This administrative fakery abounds then and now. Of course, calling a document a cabinet document when it served no such purpose should no more make it one than standing in a garage will make you a car. But this is government. This is power. Thank you, Carolyn. God bless you. As Hannah Arendt wrote on Franz Kafka, the government has the privilege of making the ultimate final decision. And so you are a car. And a ministerial brief is a cabinet document. Up is down, left is right, today is already tomorrow. They did this when dreaming up Robodebt. Some senior bureaucrats, themselves unelected officials with code of conduct obligations, who nevertheless exhibited a preternatural enthusiasm for deception of self and others, simply decided to call the tax office data trusted, which had the happy effect, they thought, of allowing them to do whatever they wanted with it, just by calling it trusted. And here's the thing about that definitional sleight of hand. It's not alchemy. Choosing to trust ATO data didn't render it trustworthy, certainly not in every form in which they intended to use it. And those same public servants would never have done the same with, say, a lion at the zoo and then sprung into the enclosure hoping for anything other than a thorough mauling. That's not how the world works. But that is how power works. I'm not only asking the officials to examine their role in this. Yes, even the good ones. But the media too. Yes, even the good ones. Even me. I failed. You could see in the exhibits how nervously some of the most highly paid public servants in Catherine Campbell and the now-deceased Melissa Golightly trawled their twice-daily media monitoring reports to check if the litany of horrors they'd unleashed had been picked up widely or not. You can almost hear the sighs of relief when they say that it was only with The Guardian Australia or New Matilda, and occasionally just with the ABC. When Peter Martin in the SMH hit the nail on the head in January 2017 with a weapon of mass destruction column, it sparked a crisis response within the Department of Human Services. Even Turnbull got involved. The Human Services Minister in 2017, Alan Tudge, used the conservative press and favoured journalists among them, like the Australian Simon Benson, we called him Hansard, to uncritically run the lawyers. Made me take that out of the book, but I don't think I should have. And I'm going to run my case here today in Coaldale. They used journalists like Simon Benson to uncritically run the government narrative and weaponise the private Centrelink data of people who had complained in other media, in the non-friendly media as the government saw them. Imagine being, quite literally, such a tool. Defensible, in the way that I said it. It wasn't just the government narrative, though. It was Tudge's narrative. He handwrote much of the material that went to Benson, and Benson ran it as is. Not just the quotes from the minister, which, of course, we all run, but the rest of the information that was written for him was regurgitated almost verbatim. And the day that his story came out was 26 January 2017, and it was the same day that Rhys Corso hit with a fake $10,000 debt and hounded by corporate debt collectors, sold onto him by Centrelink, killed himself. The same day. No one's suggesting he read that story, but that story was the background radiation of the fear that people lived in of being judged for having stolen from their government, allegedly. Rhys Corso couldn't fight his debt. He didn't know how to fight his debt. And where was I? Shrinking from my journalistic duty to at least try and counteract this perverse influence. Sure, I was writing about government attempts to kick people off the National Disability Insurance Scheme, déjà vu, and choosing my battles because I didn't know how else to bend the corporate will of the newspaper to empathy on Centrelink debt recovery. This kind of self-reflection is supposed to be uncomfortable. I do not enjoy the self-flagellation and exposure that it brings, but I do try and at least model some of the behaviour I'd like to see from our public officials. They who have delivered incredible harms at the heel of an illegal and mathematically obtuse scheme before skulking away and claiming it was all just an unfortunate oversight. Catherine Campbell, who was found by the Royal Commission to have misled Cabinet at the birth of Robodebt, says in her own defence that she wishes she had sought legal advice over the scheme. The senior policy department had legal advice, of course, which showed it was illegal, and that was communicated to Campbell's department and its effect included in all of the briefs to Scott Morrison until the language suddenly disappeared. It was nowhere to be seen in the new policy proposal that went to Cabinet. Nothing else about this brand new idea had changed between the briefs and the Cabinet documents. It was still supposed to save $1.2 billion. It was still supposed to go after 866,000 people with the exact same success rate built into it as they'd envisaged in their government modelling. But suddenly there was no mention of income averaging, the way that they were going to achieve those savings, or the need for legislation in the proposal. The words had been removed, but the dimensions remained exactly the same. What Morrison knew, or should have known, because he kept the part of the brief that explained this in rigorous detail, was that there was no way for those numbers to hold up and remain true if the income averaging underpinning the measure disappeared. Hence, the Royal Commission found he allowed Cabinet to be misled. Normal policy, don't worry about it. And from that moment and every year since, the government and its minions, not all motivated in quite the same way, but dozens and dozens who nevertheless acted improperly or scandalously, agreed to construct a new reality that diverged from the one its citizens were living in. Debts that didn't exist were now real. Legal advice that did exist was hidden from the independent ombudsman and otherwise disappeared. And strange afflictions that rendered officials speechless or incapable of writing an email swept through the ranks. Later, on the witness stand at the Robodebt Royal Commission, so many of these same people developed advanced memory loss that cannot be explained by medical science. Accountability went to the same place from which the debts emerged. Fucking nowhere. It is less surprising, perhaps, that these various maladies and paranormal happenings struck far more heavily at the middle and upper ranks of the public service. The more one earned, the less likely it was that they would lift a single QWERTY keyboard finger to put a concern in writing, if they even bothered to have any. But at the lower levels of the bureaucracy, among the plebeians who were not trusted with policy development, there was no such cluster of cowardice or catastrophic memory failures. Jeannie Marie Blake was a Centrelink compliance worker who was so traumatised by what she and others like her were made to do, handling phone calls of people who were threatening to kill themselves over these extortion attempts. And she watched the parade of senior managers take to the stand at the Royal Commission and say, "I can't recall," or "I didn't turn my mind to it," or "I don't remember." And deliberately and very slowly, she told the room, "I remember. I do not forget." Because what she saw was novel and horrific. It was seared into the architecture of her brain. Colleen Taylor, too, suffered no unexplainable ailments relating to her conduct or her ability to recall what had been done. We can deduce, pending further research, that a strong moral backbone confers a kind of immunity upon the bearer, the lack of which corrodes the hippocampus of those who have no strong moral centre, like those who programmed their prejudices into Robodebt. But Colleen Taylor, the very model of the perfect public servant, did everything she was supposed to do in exactly the right order. She'd worked on the old systems and the new, and she saw what had changed and immediately alerted her superiors. Right up the chain of command, in order of rank, the reverse peristalsis of bureaucratic hierarchy, as was expected. She told her managers in increasingly panicked and refreshingly direct language, "We are being asked to commit fraud against our customers." She put it in writing. Eventually, the Secretary Catherine Campbell was forced to send out an all-staff email in the chaos of public anger come early 2017 as the computer spat out 20,000 debts a week. They used to do 20,000 a year. Nothing has changed about how income is assessed or debts raised, the secretary cooed. This was the same hypnotist trick that was inserted into the Robodebt new policy proposal that went to Cabinet in 2015 that meddled with the language and left the actual program as it was. But Colleen Taylor knew better and, bless her, thought the secretary was being misled. Nothing has changed about how income is assessed or debts raised, the secretary cooed. This was the same hypnotist trick that was inserted into the Robodebt new policy proposal that went to Cabinet in 2015 that meddled with the language and left the actual program as it was. But Colleen Taylor knew better and, bless her, thought the secretary was being misled because she thought highly of people and she wanted to believe in them. It was such a serious mistake to be making, so she assumed it was bad advice. And over 17 pages of email, Taylor told the secretary everything that had changed and all of the problems. The averaging of income where people did not work consistently, the double counting of employer income, Coles Brisbane and the Phillips Family Trust, same thing, counted twice. The rudimentary computer system errors that failed to accept payslips that had been provided and the advice put in writing that people like Colleen Taylor should not be looking at the customer record, even if it contains the information they're looking for. Because the point of the program, they told her, was to get people to engage with Centrelink. It was a hoop, quite literally, that they were forced to jump through, even if they had already jumped through the hoop. None of this mattered. Campbell... It's like, oh my God, he's fallen apart. It's finally happened. Mother's been waiting for this day. Campbell dispatched her lieutenants to meet with Taylor for more than 2 hours, where the APS4 compliance officer went through every problem afresh, and at the end of it, the secretary's delegates took what had been given to them and made origami. So what you're telling us, they said, is that the old system was too slow and cumbersome. Colleen Taylor was subjected to a secret investigation internally, which found nothing because there was nothing to find. She was the meticulous and faithful public servant at every step of the way. But soon the faithful like Colleen were all resigning because they could not stomach what was being asked of them. They were replaced by Labour hire drones who knew nothing about the old ways or how far the new ones had descended into the depths. By the end of Robodebt, the only people who knew anything about how it really worked were those who designed it. They gave nothing away because to do so was to imperil the project. Control of information, always a feature of government, was sharpened to a point. PricewaterhouseCoopers, perhaps the first private consulting firm in history to be brought in to provide independent reassurance of the government's way of doing things and who themselves were conscious of keeping their paymasters on side, couldn't even find the room to reassure them. Their final report, the Royal Commission found, was so serious in its findings that it was hit with an anti-matter gun and Campbell's hand was on the trigger. It never even made it into the department. PricewaterhouseCoopers were still paid their $1 million fee. Legal advice from the private law firm Clayton Utz, another client of government that liked to soothe the troubled minds of their bursars, found no room at all to wriggle on its 2018 advice to the Department of Social Services, the very first such external advice in the history of Robodebt. 3 years after it began, almost four, and Campbell had killed off attempts to get external advice in 2017, so this would have been the first to make it across the final hurdle. Senior managers at DSS left the Clayton Utz advice in draft form. Just the latest in a long line of mystifying philosophical distinctions that Commissioner Catherine Holmes likened to a child putting its hands over its eyes and believing something no longer exists. Object permanence, public service edition. The government was playing with lives, and I do emphasise playing. It all seemed like such a game. One that endures today with the smoke and mirrors of accountability. We have an anti-corruption commission that is allegedly anti-corruption, clues right there in the title, and yet they took 11 months to announce what they'd decided in three, that there was nothing to see here. The media statement they released to the public to explain the inexplicable contained one misleading statement and one verifiable untruth. The word games have continued to the last. You might have expected justice. What we got is a lot less than that. You can almost hear the powers that be as they execute the final manoeuvre of language. There is no justice here. We'll just call it that. Thank you so much.
This conversation was recorded by Two Heads Media for True Story. Thanks to co-curators Sarah Nicholson and Genevieve Swart, and to the Illawarra Flame for ongoing support. The festival is held every spring in November, and we hope to see you there next time. For more information about the festival programme and other events, go to southcoastwriters.org.